The impeachment drama is over, or is it really? And where does it leave us? The implications of the Senate vote for Texas and beyond, today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. A pair of markers erected in Rio Grande City, what they say about an historic workers' strike that left a deep impression on the Texas landscape. Also, how a robot could help save the Gulf of Mexico from a rapidly reproducing lionfish. And our go-to tech guy on the return of gaming, the low-tech way. Plus, why lots of Texans won't stop talking about a certain halftime show. All those stories and more when the Texas Standard gets started, right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on the sixth day of February 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over. So declared Gerald R. Ford at his inauguration during a brief interlude between Richard Nixon's resignation in disgrace and the election of a peanut farmer from Georgia to the highest office in the land. Ford's declaration was seen at the time as somewhat premature. Nixon was out of the White House, but what the Watergate era hath really wrought was a long period of distrust of our highest democratic institutions, something that not only persists today, but has, if anything, watered some deeply rooted branches of anti-institutional populism, leaving Americans on the right and the left distrustful of the intentions of the other with predictable partisan paralysis. On this day after the third acquittal of a U.S. president, as both sides point fingers in the opposite directions, it seems fairly obvious that our national nightmare is not over. The greater question may be whether we can find a way to wake up and dream great dreams together again. To help us explore the significance of yesterday's impeachment vote, Brandon Rodinghouse, political science professor at the University of Houston. Dr. Rodinghouse, good to have you back.
You too, David. Thanks for having me.
Polls suggested we here in Texas were as divided as the rest of the nation on whether the president had committed impeachable offenses. No Texas politicians on Capitol Hill broke ranks. Does yesterday's vote change the political dynamics at all in Texas?
I don't think so. I mean, what we've seen is that polarization is still pretty alive and well. And just to paraphrase what a lot of people have said about polarization nationally, it's a heck of a drug. And it's hard to get people to change their minds. That said, there might be a couple of points where we could see some challenges to that. First of all, Republicans are less supportive of the president than they have been. The number of people disapproving of the president has increased. You also have them less certain that the investigations aren't justified than Democrats. So it could be there's some a little bit of a taint on that armor. The other thing is that independents are still politically divided. They generally are ambivalent about impeachment, but they have low approval of how Democrats handle the situation and a modest to low approval of how Trump handle the situation. So it's unclear how they'll swing, but a lot of these districts are divided by 500 to 1,000 votes. So if that has an impact, it could be that it's something that we could look for in 2020.
Well, now that's interesting because I was thinking for Republicans, you know, the question here in Texas has been how much distance do you put between yourself and a president who may turn off moderates, which is what you're talking about there. But with this acquittal vote and with President Trump now sort of running his victory laps, if you're a Texas Republican, is that issue still on the table or do you just go all in with Trump at this point?
I think they're all in with Trump. I mean, you know, John Cornyn has said publicly that, you know, he thinks the impeachment is a dangerous precedent and weaponizing impeachment the way that he argues Democrats did is a problem. He thinks it's going to help him in the fall. I'm not so sure. My sense is it's probably a kind of a net neutral, maybe a small disadvantage for Republicans. The one thing Republicans, especially John Cornyn, needed was to be able to rally Republicans. And that's something that probably will happen. And so we're going to see them repeat that on the trail. And another thing we learned about the other senator from Texas, Ted Cruz, is that he's a top podcaster, which we joke about. But the fact is that the party is going to be looking for a kind of post-Trump voice and somebody who can balance a kind of populism of Trump with a more traditional social conservative and libertarian Republican ideals is going to be successful. And Ted Cruz may have a national following to do just that.
That is very interesting. Yeah, he was top of the iTunes podcast list as a result of this impeachment. Is it possible that the president's acquittal will embolden the Trump administration on things like immigration, which has put Texas in the national spotlight with family separations at the border and the like?
Yeah, it's a great point. You know, Susan Collins, senator from Maine, said that she assumes the president has learned his lesson. I'm not sure that's true, but It's definitely the case that they've not shied away from making bold moves on any policy issue. So I don't think that we're likely to see any kind of change on that. One thing we might see, though, too, is a sort of a change within the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
This issue has become a real fault line in the U.S. Senate race. And before all this went down and the president was acquitted, you had candidates taking different positions. So MJ Hager, who is the sort of front runner, such as it is, has suggested that they should wait for evidence. Whereas Christina Tizian Ramirez has said, you know, there was enough information to go ahead and convict. So it could be that, although it's all said and done now, that it's a sort of signal of how committed Democrats are to doing anything they can to remove Trump. So that could be an issue leading into to March for the primary for Democrats.
So it could just sort of galvanize the left among Texas Democrats.
Exactly. Yeah. And sort of signal that, you know, there are some candidates who may be more moderate and some who are more progressive on that issue. And that's going to be possibly a difference maker for a Senate race that's pretty well undefined at this point.
Brandon Rodinghouse wrote the book on Texas politics, Inside Texas Politics. He's a professor at the University of Houston. Dr. Rodinghouse, thanks again for taking a few minutes out of your busy day to speak with us on the Texas Standard.
Always great, David.
More than 50 years ago, farm workers in South Texas, fed up with deteriorating work conditions and 40 cent an hour wages, went on strike. Last Friday, two historical markers commemorating the Texas farm workers' strike of 1966 were unveiled in Rio Grande City along the Texas-Mexico border, marking an historic event and the resulting movement. Texas Public Radio's Rinaldo Leaños Jr. has more.
Daria Vera is in her 70s. She carries with her a large black and white laminated photograph. In it are two young women laying down on a bridge, with both Mexican and U.S. law enforcement officers standing around, looking down at them.
Tenía 21 años. Aquí tocó que ya, ya se habían llevado los organizadores.
I was 21 years old. The Texas Rangers had locked up all the leaders, so I looked at the woman next to me and I said, this can't end this way. Well, we laid across the bridge to continue blocking it, because we were laying down across it. And the traffic was blocked up for miles on both sides of the border.
Back then, Vera and others were on the international bridge that connects Roma, Texas, some 230 miles south of San Antonio, to Ciudad Alemán, Mexico, as a sign of protest and to try and hurt the ranchers financially. At the time, she was working in the cantaloupe fields, where she and others who were picking crops earned less than half of what was then a $1.25 an hour minimum wage. Today, when she looks at the photo, Vera says she's extremely proud of the work she and others did to bring the life-threatening conditions of South Texas farm workers to the nation's attention.
Yo miedo nunca tuve. Yo siempre andaba adelante.
I was never afraid. I was always fighting. I'd tell people, if the Rangers kill us, I had a happy death fighting for our rights.
Vera and other farm workers gathered here in Rio Grande City last week to be honored for the work they did to advocate for better working conditions in the fields. The ceremony began with some songs and music that were played when the farm workers went on strike that sticky June during their 491-mile march to Austin all those decades ago. At the ceremony to mark the strike, Congressman Henry Cuellar, who represents the area, began his speech by first addressing the young people in the room.
If you want to look for your heroes, you don't have to turn on the TV or go far away or travel thousands of miles. All you have to do is look at your parents. Look at the folks that we have here. These are your heroes.
Cuellar's parents were farm workers. He said the people being celebrated in the room were part of history.
Farm workers did not have access to bathrooms or medical services. Also, wages were as low as 40 cents an hour. And workers had to resort to drinking from puddles left over from the irrigation systems. In addition, children as young as 5 had to join picking to add to the family income.
When Vera took the stage, she recalled how she started working in the fields at the age of 8 and only went to the first grade because she had to help support her family. Vera also shared her story about blocking the international bridge in Roma.
So all of the police arrived for just two women. I was holding onto the bridge and wouldn't loosen my grip. And so they twisted my arm until I had to let go because they would have broken it. They dragged me and I asked them, aren't you embarrassed that you had to bring all the police for two women to arrest? Are you scared of us?
After Vera and the others spoke, the group headed outside for the unveiling of the two markers. The first was constructed and shown 3 years ago to commemorate the farm workers' movement. The second one includes the names of local activists, including Vera.
Para que la gente sepan lo que hicimos nosotros,
porque so now the people can know that what we did because there are a lot of people who don't know, or you talk to them and they laugh because they don't believe you. But now they can read it and see what we did. We made history.
Arturo S. Rodriguez was the second president of the United Farm Workers. He was also at the unveiling.
Even though it's taken decades to bring about this monument that, or marker that we have, historical marker that we now have here, it really does demonstrate that people do not forget about those that really lifted us up, those that fought so hard, that made tremendous sacrifices, and it's never too late to really honor those individuals and to recognize the history that took place back in 1966.
Rodriguez says the fight for farm workers' rights is far from over, but says he and others will continue to advocate. For the Texas Standard, I'm Reynaldo Leaños Jr. in Rio Grande City.
Let's find out what Texans are talking about on this sixth day of January. What you seeing out there, Will Dunbar?
January, February, perchance.
You know, I'm having a little bit of a lag.
Say?
Right.
This
2019, now it's 2020.
Breezing by.
Crazy.
Well, as I think the news has something to do with that because there's so much of it. We're hearing from folks about the Senate vote to acquit President Trump on his impeachment charges and that speech and vote by Mitt Romney, the sole Republican who voted to convict the president. On her Facebook page, Carolyn Kresik Liss writes, Senator Romney's speech and his action gave me hope. I admire those that have the courage to bypass the expedient path and stand up for their convictions, doing what they feel is right. Carolyn adds, I'm also deeply saddened that for acting on his conviction, Romney is already being vilified. Eric Metzi writes that in 2012, he voted for Obama, not against Romney, and this is why. He always seemed like an honorable and honest person. Meanwhile, Matt Weiss writes that Romney's vote was a safe vote, both considering there aren't enough votes to remove the president, and the Utah Mormon conservative bloc doesn't have the rosy view of Trump that other evangelical types do. Lots to talk about, as we're just saying there, David. I'll be back with more later in the show.
A whole lot of folks weighing in, but something's missing, and that might be you. Look up Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice and get back to us, would you? Wells Dunbar's looking for you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, celebrating spring break with golf beaches, seafood, and family-friendly attractions, including Moody Gardens, dolphin watching adventures, and more. Details at galveston.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. We're still waiting for final word on the results from the Iowa caucus. Right now, Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders are nearly tied for first place. We'll keep you posted on the latest. For folks here in Texas, still 26 days till primary day. And as Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davies reports, one of the Iowa frontrunners has a plan that may be a tough sell in parts of the Lone Star State as sponsor of a bill to ban fracking.
Senator Sanders' stance opposing fracking isn't new. Here he is on the campaign trail in 2016.
When we talk about our environment, we have got to put an end to fracking.
Sanders has tweeted that fracking is a danger to our water supply. It's a danger to the air we breathe. It causes earthquakes. It's highly explosive, and it's contributing to climate change. We need to ban it nationwide. But Todd Staples, president of the Texas Oil and Natural Gas Association, says the use of hydraulic fracturing has created abundant low-cost energy, wealth, and jobs in Texas.
And this type of legislation would actually decimate millions of lives across America and would jeopardize and impair the ability to get much-needed power to our hospitals, to our homes, to our schools.
Staples, who was a Republican two-term Texas Commissioner of Agriculture, says Sanders and other Democratic candidates promising to outlaw fracking are pandering to voters and not talking about the reality of petroleum production.
And we need to understand the process that it takes to deliver reliable power to heat and cool our homes.
There is no job loss or anything there, because the fact is the industry has been hemorrhaging jobs for the last 4 years anyhow.
Mark McCord, director of Frack Dallas, has fought fracking in Dallas and says except for in the Permian Basin, there isn't much fracking going on in Texas anymore because of low prices for oil and natural gas and the high cost of overhead. He says even if fracking was booming again, Sanders couldn't do much about it.
Well, it's possible for Bernie Sanders or any other president to do that on federal land. He could not stop it on state land, and he could not stop it on private land.
And in Texas, it's the state's job to oversee activity in the oil patch, said Tom Tunstall, director of research at the University of Texas at San Antonio Institute for Economic Development.
From a practical standpoint, you know, in the case of Texas, it's the Railroad Commission that regulates the oil and gas industry.
Tunstall points out that concerns that some people have about fracking are no different than what could happen with conventional oil drilling techniques.
Most commonly, spills at the surface would seep down into the ground, or improperly cemented well casings. And those occur both with, you know, the old-time drilling rigs as well as unconventional.
Because oil and gas drilling is complicated, Staples says campaign promises to ban fracking don't actually mean much because...
Using catchphrases to misinform the public is really bad policy, and it's bad politics.
Which is an observation which can be applied to many campaign promises and candidates from both parties. In San Antonio, David Martin Davies reporting.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. When we think about gamers these days, we often visualize people playing in those high-tech chairs sitting in front of several video screens. You know what it looks like. But increasingly, the ranks of players also include fans of so-called tabletop gaming. And by this, we're talking about everything from classic card games like Uno to board games and complex strategy games featuring painted miniatures and elaborate custom-made dice. And our tech expert Omar Gayaga says tabletop gaming is on its way to becoming a $12 billion business. Omar, sounds like business is good.
Business is good, yeah. And fun.
Yeah. So what's behind the rise of these table games?
Well, there's just been this big resurgence over the last 10, 15 years in gaming. And, you know, this was a business that people thought, oh, you know, that's going by the wayside. You know, video games and cell phones are going to replace, you know, Monopoly and Life and these games that we grew up with. But no, it's actually been the opposite. People have really kind of gravitated toward these games, I think, as a response to technology. I think people have really want this analog thing of, like, I just want to sit at a table and play dice and drink some beer and mm-hmm, you know, do a board game with my friends. So Kickstarter and a lot of other crowdfunding operations have sort of funded a lot of these games, and they've become huge hits. I have a couple here on the table that we're looking at.
Yeah, it looks like you've brought a virtual party here. This is...
we're going to play some games afterward, David.
Yeah, Throw Burrito, a dodgeball card game. It looks like basically this consists of a table game involving throwing burritos at your opponent.
Burritos you throw at each other. It's a card game, but when you get certain cards, you get up off the table and you chase each other around and throw burritos. It's really fun.
Another one there, I think I've heard of this one. This was a Kickstarter at one time?
Exploding Kittens was the artist from the Oatmeal kind of created all the artwork for the cards, and it became this huge hit. I was one of the Kickstarter backers. I have the original Kickstarter backer box that does this.
Oh, very cute. So a limited edition box there with a complete with the kitten audio. And then this here, I am told, is kind of a real success story. Azul.
There's three editions of this from a designer who just crafted this beautiful tile game that my family has gotten addicted to. It's become a big hit the last 2 years.
I love how tactile and beautiful these the pieces are.
Oh, the tiles are beautiful. Game board is gorgeous. Yeah.
You just want to learn how to play it just to get to feel these things. It's really interesting.
They're beautiful and pricey sometimes.
Are they?
Some of these games are upwards of $40, $50. I mean, I've spent a couple of $100 on Zombicide, which is a Walking Dead style miniatures survival game over the years.
For those who may be tuning in late, you may recognize that as the voice of our go-to tech expert, Omar Gayaga, and yet we're not talking about high-tech games. What's the connection here?
Mostly how they've been funded is online and Kickstarter, and there's also been this whole community built around tabletop gaming with videos, with websites that are devoted to reviewing these games and playing them, and it's even kind of come back around to live performances of Dungeons and Dragons games and people on stage playing them. And so it's really, and a lot, if you go to any big gaming conference, now there's usually a big tabletop section at the game conference dedicated to these kind of games.
See, I'm wondering if there's a like-mindedness going on here, because I've taken, for instance, my teenage boy to like a party with some friends at one of these video game places, right? They love to just game together. And then you see a whole section, and I know that some of our producers here do this as well, a section in this, what I think of as like a kind of a video game parlor, I suppose you could say, which is devoted to these tabletop games.
Yeah, there are now bars and coffee shops that have gaming nights, or their whole function is to get people together and play these games. You either rent the table or get a membership, and that's your whole thing. It's your game night.
So what, Monopoly isn't good enough for you these days?
I just saw a commercial for an edition of Monopoly that has an Alexa speaker in the middle, and you do everything as voice. I swear I saw this commercial. I was like, what?
That's crazy.
So there's an Alexa edition, basically, of Monopoly now.
So what goes around comes around, I guess.
Yeah, there is some melding of high tech and analog, but I think what people like about these games is it gets you together with your friends. You get to enjoy this tactile sensation of dice or cardboard or whatever. And, you know, some of these games, I think the new wave is just really beautifully designed, fun to play games. Gaming is gaming.
Well, when Omar Gayaga isn't rolling the dice or shuffling the cards, you can check him out over at techminutetexas.com. And I bet you he'll have some great recommendations for you over there. Good to see you again, Omar. We'll see you again next week.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on 29 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. Maybe we can hear that meow one more time if you want to. Yeah, the Texas Roundup coming up next.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from Abilene Christian University, focusing on student success within key areas like service learning, first-year experiences, and learning communities. More at acu.edu.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Central Texas Congressman Michael McCaul is joining calls to censure House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. The Austin Republican criticized the San Francisco Democrat on Fox News Channel this morning for tearing up a copy of President Trump's speech after Tuesday's State of the Union address.
Nancy Pelosi's her behavior was shameful on the House floor. I think the president deserves an apology, but that won't happen. And you know, we'll have a censure vote today.
McCaul says it's unlikely the Democrat-controlled House will censure Pelosi. At a press conference this hour, the speaker criticized the content of Trump's State of the Union address. Meanwhile, San Antonio Congressman Joaquin Castro says the U.S. House should continue investigating the president following his impeachment acquittal in the Senate Wednesday. The Democrat says more evidence will emerge to prove Trump abused his power and obstructed Congress.
I leave it to Speaker Pelosi and to the intelligence chairman, Adam Schiff, and also the judiciary chairman, Jerry Nadler, to decide on the specific witnesses. But I believe that these things will continue to be pursued in the House of Representatives.
Both U.S. senators from Texas voted with nearly all of their fellow Republicans to acquit Trump. Texas is set to carry out its second execution of the year tonight, Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner reports.
Abel Ochoa, now 47, is scheduled to die by lethal injection for killing two family members in 2002, his wife Cecilia and his older 7-year-old daughter Crystal. In his confession to police, Ochoa said he'd wanted more money for his cocaine habit and knew his wife wouldn't give him any more. So he grabbed his gun in his South Dallas home and started shooting. Three other family members also died, including his 9-month-old daughter, his sister-in-law, and father-in-law. The only survivor was another sister-in-law of Ochoa's, Alma Alviso. In past appeals to reduce his sentence, as well as his latest one to the U.S. Supreme Court, he said his trial lawyers didn't bring up his difficult childhood. Texas has 7 other executions scheduled through May. I'm Sasha Cordner in Houston.
Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio is preparing to quarantine American citizens who may have been exposed to the coronavirus while in China. The base held a town hall last night to address concerns from personnel and their families. Dr. Larry Schlesinger heads the Texas Biomedical Research Institute in San Antonio. He says it's challenging to respond to infectious diseases around the world.
But I think the global community is rising to this occasion more quickly, having learned from previous outbreaks. I mean, if things change, and we haven't done some of this reactive force, if you will, then we'll be questioning that as well.
Lackland is expected to house up to 250 evacuees. I'm Joseph Leahy.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The lionfish is a scourge in the Gulf of Mexico. A beautiful creature, to be sure, but a scourge nonetheless. It's native to the South Pacific and Indian Oceans, but has developed a healthy population in the Gulf and the Caribbean thanks to aquarium owners dumping their tropical pets into the deep blue sea. The problem is that the lionfish has no real predators in this part of the world, and it's very good at hunting fish that sustain coral reefs, like algae eaters that eat bacteria on the coral. So far, there's no real solution that's put much of a dent in the lionfish population. But that might change. Here to tell us more is Gavin Hunter. He's the CEO of a Bermuda-based company, Atlantic Lionshare. Gavin, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you very much.
First, give us a sense of the scale of the lionfish problem in the Atlantic and Gulf of Mexico.
Well, it's very difficult to determine the scale because counting fish is an impossible task. But I think you just have to look at what the nature of the fish, and a single female lionfish lays up to 3 million eggs in a year. Mm. We've got no way of determining how many actually then reach maturity, or so it's a big guess, but it's got to be doubling at least every year.
Wow. But though there's no way to count them, I guess there might be a way to actually capture the lionfish en masse. You've developed a machine called the Reef Sweeper. How does it work?
The Reef Sweeper is a remotely operated vehicle, so we operate it from our boats, and it actually spears the lionfish. The lionfish have no sense of predators because they don't have any natural predators, so we're able to take these ROVs up to populations of lionfish and spear them, and then we bring them into the machine, and the fish themselves are a highly nutritious fish, and so we take them to market.
How does the marketplace use them?
Well, they're sushi-grade fish, and nutritionally, they're one of the best fish in the sea because they're eating the juveniles of most of their prey, and consequently, they're not picking up the metals and anything else that you would find in some of the larger fish.
Interesting. Now, let's describe the rover itself. I saw a video the other day, and it looks like, it's hard to tell how big it is, but it looks sort of like a square box with wheels on it.
Yeah, that's as good a description as I've heard. It's probably the size of an average refrigerator, I'd have thought. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of stuff going on in there. So we've got the spears, we've got suction things, and obviously the engines, the computers, the lights. So there's a lot of stuff tucked into one big box.
And so it's rolling along the seabed, is that right?
No. It's like a submarine. It has propellers, and so it's not actually on the seabed. No, it floats.
Interesting, because it looked like it was crawling along something. Maybe I was looking at the side of some kind of seawall or something, but it was fascinating to watch it in action. But once you catch all these lionfish, I guess what do you does it go into the top of the vehicle or come in through the side or
it comes in through a tube, uh-huh. And so the spear retracts once it has the lionfish,
right?
And we take the lionfish off the spear, and then we use thrusters to manage the lionfish back into our holding cage, and when we have enough, we come to the surface and pour them out.
Ah. So once you've captured all these lionfish, then you take them to what, a local market, a sea merchant? What do you do with that?
It depends on the environment. In Bermuda, we've been using a local wholesaler, and we can't keep up with demand. So it goes into the grocery stores, it goes into local restaurants. In the States, there's Whole Foods are buying everything that can be caught at the moment.
Right.
It's part of their sustainability program. And again, we work with local communities to provide the fish in whatever is the most suitable form.
One rover obviously is not going to be enough to solve the lionfish problem as they have it in the Gulf of Mexico. What's your vision on how this scales up to make a big dent?
Well, we expect to get to hundreds of reef sweepers as we go along. At the moment, we're just finishing off the prototyping, so we're not selling or franchising them at this stage, but we do expect later this year to be in that position. And so we're just, I would expect there to be hundreds, because there are absolutely millions, if not trillions, of lionfish out there. They're not just a scourge of the US. They're all the way through South America. They're in the Mediterranean. They're a serious, serious problem.
Gavin Hunter is the CEO of Atlantic Lionshare. This is the company behind the Lionfish Catching Reef Sweeper, and we invite you to check out a video of it on our website, texasstandard.org. Mr. Hunter, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on Standard.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at savenowforcollege.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on.
Howdy, it's the Texas Standard. Oh, to be able to own a pair of handcrafted boots. While producing our From Heel to Toe segment on stories about Texans and their boots, we learned from many of you that you saved for years to own that special pair. Others bought them secondhand to be able to own some fine materials and craftsmanship at a fraction of the cost, don't you know? Others get their boots as one might obtain a family heirloom.
My name is Marcy Robertson. I drive a school bus, which I've been doing for 25 plus years and hoping to retire soon. I've been taking dance lessons for 3 or 4 years now, including my boyfriend teaching me mostly. That's where I've learned a lot of the Western dancing is from him. I do two-step and triple two-step and waltz. I've done some Lindy and some swing. People have come up to us and complimented us. We met after I had gotten divorced. He actually had made a necklace that I was wearing, even though I didn't know that he'd made it. We got it from the Renaissance Festival years ago. The man who is now my boyfriend, at the time, he recognized the necklace. And I said, well, this is where we got it. And he says, well, I think I made that. So that was pretty cool. And our first date was at Luckenbach. And we only danced a couple of dances because I had just broken my finger. And that's my twirling hand. So I couldn't really dance very much. And the boots I was wearing were not broken in because I hadn't worn them that much. They belonged to my mom, and she passed away in 2010, and I found them in the closet. She wore them when she worked at the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo back in the late 60s, early 70s. She met a lot of the stars, and Sammy Smith's signature is inside one of the boots. She sang Help Me Make It Through the Night.
Take the ribbon from my hair, shake it loose and let it fall.
When I got them, I just put them in my closet and they stayed there for probably 4 or 5 years. I got a chance to wear them finally, and I've broken them in pretty well now. So, I think my mom would be really happy to know that I'm wearing them and dancing, because she loved to dance. I think about her every time that I wear them. It's just special, everything. The boots, the boyfriend, the dance, You know, I feel in like I'm in a fairy tale sometimes.
Help me make it through the night.
The voice of Marcy Robertson. If you found a pair of boots and were able to give them a second chance in life, or if the boots gave you a second chance, scoot on over to Texas Standard at KUT.org and tell us all about them. The Super Bowl is so last weekend, and yet there are several storms that won't settle down in social media and even in traditional media, alternately celebrating and criticizing that halftime show. As you probably know, the show was headlined by two Latinas, Jennifer Lopez and Shakira, with cameos by J Balvin and Bad Bunny. Depending on who you are, the Washington Post says it was a celebration of diversity or it was porn. It was either a gorgeous spectacle or inappropriate. It was the best halftime performance thus far or the XXXFL. So what exactly is going on with these conversations? Joining us once again is Dr. Nicole Guidotti Hernandez. She is a fellow at Harvard's Charles Warren Center for Studies in American History and a professor at Emory in Atlanta. She specializes in Mexican-American and Latino studies. Thanks so much for coming back to speak with us on the Texas Standard, Dr. Guidotti Hernandez.
It's a pleasure to be back. Thank you.
Let's talk about why it is you think that these conversations won't go away.
Well, I actually want to take us back to the Janet Jackson moment.
For those who might have forgotten, this was the wardrobe malfunction Super Bowl, as I recall.
Yes, the wardrobe malfunction Super Bowl. And I think that we're having a very similar conversation to when Janet Jackson's breast was exposed when she performed with Justin Timberlake. And I really think it has to do with the complicated historical narratives around the bodies of women of color and their historic kind of connotations of being hypersexualized. And so for many people, this performance of Shakira and J-Lo was about cultural pride, the showing of their physical skills. There were these really important kind of signifying moments around race and inclusion and diversity. Mm-hmm. There was also critique of immigration policy with kids in cages, right? J-Lo's daughter comes out of a cage.
Right.
But then we also have to look at these other signifiers. Like J-Lo's first outfit for me was kind of a bondage outfit. So on the one hand, you can't have a Super Bowl in Miami without having Latino performers,
right,
because Miami is a Latino metropolis.
Right.
But on the other hand, I can also see how a mainstream Anglo-American audience that has concerns about propriety could potentially see the show as over-sexualized. But I would also argue that that is a function of the way that Latinos are always already seen as hypersexualized, in the same way that Black women are seen as hypersexualized.
You have a lot of intersections here, because it's not just gender and race, as you've been pointing out. I mean, the New York Times had an op-ed, as I recall, I believe it was the New York Times, a woman who wrote that she felt like she had been body shamed by J-Lo's mere appearance in the Super Bowl. J-Lo's 50. And she sort of seemed to be suggesting, are we all supposed to now look that good when we're aged 50? And there's certain ageism baked into that.
Right. And also, I would say classism, right? Because in order to maintain a body like that, you have to have money. And then I would also say there's the political element, which is all the African-American performers and Afro-Latina performers like Cardi B or Rihanna, right, who refused to do the halftime show in solidarity with Colin Kaepernick. And so what does it say about these Latina artists doing this performance in Latinx Miami, right, as a show of solidarity and community, right, critique of immigration, kid in the cage, etc.? But then there's an alignment with the NFL. One of the fascinating things about American culture right now is that there is indeed this polarization. It's either good or bad.
Or right? Your family can just be dancing in front of the TV on Super Bowl Sunday, which was what we saw happen in living rooms across the nation at the time. So what I'm wondering here is that has this become a kind of safe space for us to have a kind of surrogate for the conversation that we're not having because we are so polarized?
Yes. This is the surrogate space for the conversation. And I think it's very fitting that it's happening under the guise of quote unquote entertainment. The Super Bowl halftime show has become a means by which Americans work out their feelings about America. Hmm. And I think that the afterlives of this performance are going to take on different reverberations because of the way that Latinos are so front and central as part of the immigration conversation in the United States. And in terms of the 2020 election, you know, that primaries and caucuses are happening as we speak.
It's a fascinating subject. Dr. Nagel Guidotti-Hernandez is one of those following it. She is a fellow at Harvard's Charles Warren Center for Studies in American History, and she's also a professor at Emory University in Atlanta. Thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard. Professor, good to chat with you again.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. That burger you're eating? Bet you didn't know there's a good chance it came from the Texas Panhandle. That's because the region produces a fifth of the nation's beef supply, and you know that takes a lot of cattle. How much? Well, consider this. In Deaf Smith County, cattle outnumber people 40-1. And with all that cattle comes a lot of manure. Now, at this point, if you really are eating that burger, you might want to turn down the radio for a few minutes, because what reporter Chris Collins has been covering is not that appetizing, important though it may be. Collins is a staff writer with the Texas Observer, and he spent 4 months investigating how a certain pollutant affects Texans and how the state does little to address it. Chris, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hey, David, thanks for having me on. And you're right, this is not the the best lunchtime content, so
no,
if you're squeamish, yeah.
Yeah. Let's just say the phrase fecal dust and get it out of the way. I think I know what we're talking about here. But I don't think I've heard about it described as the problem which you report on. What exactly, I suppose we should say, is fecal dust properly understood?
Sure. Well, fecal dust is just about what it sounds like. This is the product of manure that's excreted by cattle in a feedlot. In Jeff Smith County alone, which is in the Texas Panhandle, relatively close to Amarillo, there are hundreds of thousands of cattle at a time that sit in feedlots. They don't do much but sit and eat and poop. And in the Panhandle, it's dry, it's hot, and it's windy. So what happens is they poop all day. That manure is dried by the sun. And then in the evenings, when it starts to cool off, the cattle get a little more energized. They start to stomp around, and they send this dust into the air where it's caught by the wind and then blown onto anybody who may be unfortunate enough to be in close proximity to it.
Now, I know that it's a problem just from the standpoint of the awful smell and what it does, you know, to the surroundings and everything. But what about fecal dust as a health problem? How long has that been understood to be an issue?
There's been research done about this, and basically the pollutants that we're talking about here that are going to be associated with cattle feedlots in the Panhandle are going to be air pollutants, and generally this is going to be ammonia and particulate matter. These are both byproducts of manure. Ammonia is a contributor to regional haze, and it can cause breathing problems. Particulate matter, which is basically the very small particles of dirt and the poop that's been stomped and blown into the wind, is very, very small little pieces that can be breathed in and penetrate deep into the lungs and also cause breathing problems once that happens. And the health problems that can come from that are things like shortness of breath, asthma, and things of that nature, generally respiratory problems.
Well, so have people there been complaining about this for a long time? And reason I ask is because you would think that if there were a lot of complaints, you wouldn't have more feedlots expected to open in the region, but that seems to be exactly what's happening.
I reviewed a data set that was obtained through an open records request from the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. That's the state regulatory agency that's in charge of environmental laws. And as I was going through there, I found, you know, a set of these complaints about a problem I had not heard about, which was that fecal dust was blowing onto these communities, was making it hard to breathe, was really affecting people's health and quality of life. And there have been quite a few, you know, at least 100 complaints. Unfortunately, the state regulatory agency does not appear to have done much with those complaints. There have not been enforcement actions as far as fines and warnings against cattle feedlots with respect to those complaints, even though those complaints appear to be numerous. And you're right that this is a large industry and this is a growing industry. In Deaf Smith County, at least, there is plans to add another 50,000 head exactly in this area where people are having what seems to be the most severe problem with fecal dust.
We've been speaking with reporter Chris Collins of The Observer, which in collaboration with the Food and Environment Reporting Network and the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting, spent 4 months looking at how fecal dust is affecting Texans and what's being done or not about it. Chris, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard. We appreciate it.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. He's back, our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, that is. What are you seeing out there, Wells?
Hi, David. Well, we're hearing from folks about the story we just shared, that issue with fecal dust in cattle ranching portions of the Texas Panhandle and its effect on the people there. On our Facebook page, Kat Varble has been in the region. She writes, "There's no greenery for miles. I drove past there in September, and it was all dirt and cows. It was a really disturbing sight." She writes that she's used to seeing the grazing cows in the rest of the state, but what they have out there is wild. And Jaime Solorza, he shares a similar story talking about driving through Dalhart a little bit further north and saying he was just, hit by the issues described in that piece. So a very evocative piece that we shared a link to on the trusty Texas Standard website there at texasstandard.org. Folks can check it out. Also hearing from several people about the ongoing discussion of the Super Bowl halftime show and those intersectional issues of gender, age, ethnicity, politics, all these issues that sort of arose there. Tim Davis writes that he's sick of the manufactured outrage and writes that in the 1980s, Cher had fewer clothes on, and so did the Maroon 5 guy just from a couple years ago. I've seen like this meme going around of, what's his name? Adam Levine.
Yeah, Adam Levine.
Where he's like shirtless and covered in tattoos and glaring. And meanwhile, you got the performers there at halftime on Sunday. Morgan Hamilton says that the hypersexualization isn't really much worse than many halftime shows for big games these days. And she said she loved one moment, especially this subtle jab she described of a feathered coat that was the U.S. flag on one side and the Puerto Rican flag on the other that I believe was paired there with Born in the USA. She called that bit perfect. And Caitlin Anderson, she also calls it a non-issue for the majority of people, these complaints of is overly suggestive. She says only the pearl clutchers are upset. No one else cares. Hearing from a lot of folks today about all these issues.
You know, I was reading a story the other day that said that the Super Bowl performers don't get paid. They don't get paid a penny. Apparently, it is for pop stars what Oprah is for book authors.
Yeah.
It's you make an appearance and kablooey.
Yeah.
Apparently,
J-Lo
and Shakira both blowing up on Spotify and elsewhere.
I believe it. You know, I got to say, we're hearing from all sorts of stuff on the show today. Even from people about that another show from earlier, that underwater device that destroys the invasive lionfish in the Gulf of Mexico. And again, folks, you got to see this thing in action. It's pretty wild.
I bet we
shared
have
that
a video.
Videos on our Twitter page there. I just look for Texas Standard. You can see it in action and get some sort of Terminator flashbacks going there or illusions. via Twitter, Jet Bakes, he tweets us that he had fried lionfish in Belize and it was delicious. Light and flaky whitefish, basically.
They say it's good stuff.
Yeah, it doesn't sound too bad at all there.
We were talking about pop stars just a minute ago. Yeah. I see here Houston Chronicle has a bit of breaking news.
Oh, yeah? What we got?
Lizzo's Rodeo Houston show sells out in a matter of minutes.
Oh, man.
May have broken some new records there.
Heck yeah, it would.
Pretty interesting. She's going to be performing March 13th. Inside NRG Stadium, and as I believe March 13th is Black Heritage Day.
Yeah, actually. I always love the mix of performers, the country, R&B, hip-hop, rock, great stuff.
Terrific, terrific mix. Listen, we're out of time for the big broadcast, but the news continues, as Wells was alluding to, over at texasstandard.org. We're going to be back here on the wireless set tomorrow or on your podcasting device. We hope you will join us then. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the Texas Standard crew, wishing you a terrific Thursday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.